Welcome to the Just Pod, a podcast by the Criminal Justice Section of the ABA, the unified voice of criminal justice. Welcome to this episode of the Just Pod. Today, we are joined by three participants to help us review the history of our standards project. So before we jump into our questions, let me first introduce each of them. Bruce Green is the Lewis Stein Chair at Fordham Law School, where he directs the Lewis Stein Center for Law and Ethics. He is also our current standards project chair. And Bruce is also one of our former criminal justice section chairs as well. Jessica Roth is a professor of law and co-director of the Jacob Burns Center for Ethics in the Practice of Law at Cardozo Law School. And Jessica is the reporter to the Fair Trial and Public Discourse Standards. We also have Ion Main, law professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Law School. He is the reporter for the Standards on Diversion and currently a co-chair of the ABA Criminal Justice Sections Committee on Procedure and Evidence, and is also a co-chair of the academic committee. So each of our participants is very busy, and we really appreciate each of them making time to join us for this historical review today. So thank you to all of you for being here.
Happy to be here. Thank you, Emily.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
We have a lot to cover, so we'll just jump into our interview questions. And as I indicated, there are three participants, and so we're eager to hear from all of them. Bruce, would you please tell our listeners about the origins of the Standards Project?
Okay, so I have to confess, I was not involved at the early stages in 1963 when the idea arose. I was 8 years old at the time. And it really began, if you think about it, 1963 was the beginning of the Warren Court criminal justice revolution. And things were really changing in the criminal area. And also, things were unsettled. And at that point, the suggestion was made that it would be good for a group to get together and try to essentially put together best practices for all phases of the criminal justice area. And one of the people who was involved in the very early stages was Ed Lombard, who was the chief judge of the Second Circuit. And he looked at it and others looked at it and said, this is a great idea. And so then ABA President Lewis Powell, later Supreme Court Justice, appointed a committee of around 10 people to oversee a drafting project. And the drafting project involved around 100 different academics, judges, prosecutors, defense lawyers, who worked on different, basically, task forces on what began as 6 and then became 7 different subject areas. And the first chair of the committee, it was a much more distinguished committee back in those days, was Warren Burger, who then had to leave when he became a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He was a DC Circuit judge at the time. And so basically, beginning from 64 on, this group worked to develop basically codifications, standards on criminal justice that became 17 different sets of standards that the ABA House of Delegates reviewed and adopted over a period from 1968 to 1973. And so if you think about it, the whole project, which was immense, was a decade-long project to develop these standards.
Thank you, Bruce. You kind of touched on this, but just for the sake of clarity for our listeners, as they're trying to keep track of our history as we review it, how many volumes were included in the first edition of the standards, and what topics did they cover?
By the time the decades-long project was completed, there were 17 different volumes of standards, and they addressed a whole range of topics. So some of them addressed different procedural stages of a criminal proceeding, from pretrial release to discovery to speedy trial, joinder and severance, appellate review, post-conviction remedies. Some of them dealt with cross-cutting issues, like one what was then called fair press free trial, which became something that was reviewed and revised over the course of the next 50 or so years. And Jessica will talk more about that. Some sets of standards dealt with the role of particular players in the process. So there were prosecution and defense function standards, which I think are still tremendously important. I have my students read those. There was one on the trial judge, some on policing. There was one on urban police function, another on electronic surveillance. I don't know if I've mentioned them all, but that was essentially a lot of the 17 different standards.
Thank you. Now let's talk about the process of developing or updating our standards. Jessica and Ion, would you please share with our listeners what the process is and what your experiences have been in working on a standards task force?
I'm happy to talk about the process. It was a multi-year process, and I started working on this, I think, in 2010. I was approached by Ron Goldstock, who had already been appointed to chair the task force on revising the Fair Trial and Free Press standards, and he reached out to me. I had just become a law professor, having previously been a federal prosecutor, and asked if I would be the reporter for the task force. And so I signed on, and it was a wonderful task force that had about, I think, 12 members or so, and it had other academics. It had at least one federal district court judge, state court judges, defense lawyers, prosecutors, people who had worked in the media, people who had worked inside police forces, sometimes in roles where they were communicating with the media about cases. And our task force met, I think, about 6 times to decide how we should revise the pre-existing standards, because we were going to be creating the 4th edition. So these standards had already been through 3 iterations. And really, our charge was to update them for sort of the new technology era, because the law actually hadn't changed all that much since the 3rd edition, but the facts had changed. And so we were really trying to update those standards for the new reality of the digital era, the 24-hour news cycle. So we went through the task force process for over a year. And then once we had a set of standards that the task force was happy with, we went to the criminal justice section, to the standards committee, of the criminal justice section for approval. And there was a lot of back and forth there. But then once we had revised them so that the criminal justice section standards committee was happy with them, from there, they went to the House of Delegates for full approval by the ABA. I think I may have left out a step or two, which Bruce can...
They went to the council. For 2 readings. It may have been so painful that you forgot about it.
Yes. These were substantive review. But once they were finally approved, then we wrote the commentary. And that's a big part of the reporter's job, is writing the accompanying commentary with the standards that finally gets published with them. But that does not have to be approved beyond the task force and the standards committee.
Great. Thank you. Ion, would you please share your experiences as well?
Sure. I was asked by the extraordinary judge, Bernice Donald, to come in as reporter for, I'm actually not sure what the title was at the time. The actual title of what are now the diversion standards, that itself was subject to a lot of debate and discussion. And unlike Jessica, I guess where she's dealing with a reality that has changed, going from 1 edition to another, this one, in many respects, started with a blank page because there have not been any diversion standards, and the ABA was stepping into a place that has been under development since the late 90s, but has not been in any way kind of examined by the ABA. And what's fascinating is, and I really like hearing from Bruce, that the first set of standards took about 10 years. It means we're right on time with the diversion standards. And this goes to what Jessica was saying, is that the reality actually is changing very quick in this space. And so, you know, what we thought about diversion, I would say 4 years ago, because of the innovations of folks on the ground, and also some people who have just, for whatever reason, have been more regional or local in what they've done, but have been innovating for years, and we just didn't know about it. And part of the process is actually finding out what the reality is. So we've been working really hard with a wonderful task force, and you know, Linda Britton is doing an amazing job as director of standards, and we have a great task force involving, as Jessica mentioned, a huge number of stakeholders. And similar to her mix, I would say it's a little more behavioral health heavy on ours, given the nature of diversion itself, which also makes lawyers like me have to reach out to communities that I usually don't interact with, which has been very educational from my point of view. and I've learned a huge amount and been really impressed by the amount of time people who certainly are within the ABA who would give us, but also outside the ABA who are willing to speak with us in a very detailed way for a long time, multiple times, so that we can kind of reflect and capture what they're doing and seeing if we can turn it into a standard. So I would say that over the last 5 years, I guess, as we're doing this, the title has changed, the standards themselves have changed with the changing reality that's going on. We're going to have to, obviously, at a certain point, say these are the standards. But it's a fascinating place to be just because it's so dynamic.
Thank you both for sharing your experiences. It's a great way for us to get a better understanding for how the standards evolve and what function they aim to serve. So thank you for that. Jessica, you spoke to this a bit, but again, just for sake of clarity for our listeners as they're trying to keep track of the process, once a set of standards are approved, what happens? And then where can they be found?
So once the what we call the black letter of the standards is approved, meaning the actual text that constitutes the ABA's recommendations in this area, once that black letter has been approved, then we go into writing the commentary that explains it, which I described a moment ago. And both the black letter and the accompanying commentary are published by the ABA in a booklet form that people can buy on the ABA's website. The black letter alone is also available for people to view and download from the ABA's website without having to purchase it. So the commentary can only be found in this booklet that you have to buy. But the black letter, the actual standards, people can just go onto the ABA's criminal justice section website and look at it to see what the ABA has to say on a particular subject. And it's nicely organized with a table of contents for each set of standards. So if people are interested in a particular issue, for example, what is the standard about what prosecutors should be thinking about when they speak to the press about criminal cases, there's a particular standard in our set that focuses on that. And if they want to just click on the hyperlink for that standard, they can do so. Or they can scroll through and read the entire book of standards on that subject matter.
All right, thank you. So speaking of using the standards, Bruce, I'd like to circle back, if we can, to more of that historical information. The standards have been around since, I guess I can't quite remember the year when they were first
approved. For the first set approved was 1968. The
okay.
whole set of standards by 73 had been approved, the first
right.
edition.
And as we talk about how they've been used over the years, hopefully our listeners are familiar with using the standards, but in case they aren't, can you give us an idea of how these standards have been used since their inception?
So over the last almost 50 years, they've been used in various ways. They've certainly been used a lot by the courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court. I should mention that these aren't the only ABA work product that is given a lot of significance by the courts, including the Supreme Court. I would want to give a shout out to the death penalty standards, which are under the auspices of the Death Penalty Representation Project, and also, of course, the ABA Model Rules of Professional Conduct, which are under the supervision of the Center for Professional Responsibility. But certainly the ABA criminal justice standards have gotten a lot of use by the courts on a whole range of issues, certainly on the question of what is competent defense representation in the ineffective assistance of counsel cases. The ABA work product has gotten a lot of attention, but all, across a whole range of issues. The last study of this that I am aware of is actually about 10 years old. Martin Marcus, a judge in New York who was one of my predecessors as chair of the Standards Committee, wrote a terrific article, which is posted on the Criminal Justice Section website, called The Making of the ABA Criminal Justice Standards, 40 Years of Excellence. So that was done for the 40th anniversary. And he talked about the hundreds and hundreds of cases where the criminal justice standards have been cited by the Supreme Court and by other courts, both federal and state. Also, one of the objectives is to influence legislation. And so the hope is that as state and Congress are enacting legislation relating to criminal procedure and criminal justice, that the standards will have some influence. The standards essentially are ABA policy. And so when the ABA lobbies on criminal justice issues, they draw on the ABA standards to reflect their policy. And so another area in which they're used, and part of the reason why they've been influential in the Supreme Court, is that the ABA uses them as the basis of some of the amicus briefs that the association files in the Supreme Court and in other courts. But I would say that ideally the most important influence is on lawyers, judges, you know, prosecutors, defense lawyers, and other players in the criminal process. The ideal is that when they have issues, they'll pick up the standards, as Jessica suggested. You know, if you're a prosecutor who has a question about what can I say and should I say to the press about an ongoing case, you know, the ideal is that they'll pick up the standards and be guided by them. The standards are not law the way a statute might be, or the way an ethics rule adopted by a state court is law. Sometimes they become law when courts rely on them for judge-made law, but they reflect what is viewed as the best practices by prosecutors, defense lawyers, judges, and academics who are involved in the process. And so the hope is that people who are wondering what they should do will pick up the standards and be guided by them.
Thank you.
Emily, if I could jump in and just add something on
yes,
that.
Yes, I would love for you to. Go ahead.
Yeah, so one of the things that we did in the standards, in the version that is accompanied by the commentary in this pamphlet form, which was something that had been done in prior editions as well, but we just continued it, is we provide cross-references after every black letter standard to provisions of the Model Rules of Professional Conduct and to other sources that lawyers interested in that issue might want to consult in deciding how to proceed. So for example, our standards about extrajudicial speech, so speech out of court to the press, there is a corresponding Model Rule of Professional Conduct 3.6. And so we cite that so that a lawyer who's really wanting to research the issue thoroughly has in one easy place things that they should be looking at next. So they've consulted the criminal justice standard. Now let's look at the model rule. There is might also be something on the issue from the National District Attorneys Association. If so, that is cited as well. There might be a regulation issued by the Department of Justice that applies to federal prosecutors, et cetera. And so it provides those cross-references for ease of use by those in the field who might want to pursue the issue further.
Well, thank you for elaborating on that for us. I think that's great insight. Thank you, Jessica. And thank you, Bruce, for sharing that history of the impact of the standards.
I wanted to jump in real quick on something to supplement the comments of Bruce and Jessica. And I think when Bruce was talking about the different ways that the standards have been used, they've been used by, as he mentioned, legislatures, by lawyers, as Jessica mentioned, and by courts. Part of it, the underlying theme there is their legitimacy. And I think part of that legitimacy comes from the deep consensus that emerges and is expressed through these standards. And that process itself, when we mention that there's a task force and we mention there's a standards committee, of course, which Bruce chairs, and we mentioned that there's a council, all of those moments are really intense. And they're more than just a day. I mean, the task force meets, as Jessica said, at least six times for her task force, and that's certainly true for Aj. Those are 2 or 3 day meetings, each one. You go by line, bring speakers in. So those are really involved. And then when we go to the standards committee, that itself is a line by line reading with a very diverse set of stakeholders. And again, usually takes multiple days. And then when it goes to council, you're in front of a ring of esteemed people who are prosecutors and judges and that. And if I remember correctly, I don't know if this is true always, Jessica and Bruce, but certainly when I saw this process occur, it seemed to me it was a really kind of intimidating U-shaped kind of formation of the council and then a very small desk at the front of the room that the reporter sits at. And that's given me nightmares. But the process itself is, there's a lot of, and when I say this, I don't mean coercive way, interrogation, like really interrogating what we mean by at the end of this, each word. And so the process it goes through and the resources that the ABA puts into this, I think is part of that underlying theme that Bruce mentioned, which is this legitimacy of these standards.
Well, since Ian made that point, I really have to thank Ian and Jessica and all the current and past reporters, because the amount of effort that they put into this and the willingness to tolerate being scrutinized at so many levels is just jaw-dropping. And when they finally, you know, when Jessica finally got the standards that she'd worked on approved and then had to go back and write commentary and then have that reviewed by the standards committee, I'm just amazed at the stamina and really the public-spiritedness of all the people who work as reporters and engage in this process for what can be well over a decade. So many people deserve a shout out. Rory Little, who's the reporter to the Prosecution Defense Function Standards, has been working for well over a decade on that and is currently working on the commentary. I do have to give a shout out, although Jessica did already, to Linda Britton, who's the staff member, whose essentially full-time job is working with these standards. And we have been blessed in the ABA criminal justice section for at least the more than 10 years I've been involved in having phenomenal members of the ABA staff who work with us, without whom we could not possibly do this work. So I do think that the point that Ian makes about the legitimacy of these standards being a product of the incredible work and diversity of viewpoints that goes into it. Not only are the members highly diversified, but also a lot of the organizations have representatives in the process, including the Justice Department, which in the time I've been working has had phenomenal representatives working on these projects, and the National District Attorneys Association, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, the NAAG, the Attorney General's Association, and other groups have been involved in this process. And so it really does reflect, I think, the best thinking. But the one thing which I'd be interested in hearing I and Jessica talk about is it also involves compromise. When I read the earliest descriptions of the work product going back to the 60s and 70s, one of the points that's emphasized is that no individual person involved in this process would embrace every single rule that's adopted, but that there's a spirit of compromise that goes into the work. And I'd sort of be interested, since they talked about the process, whether Ian and Jessica have any reflections on that.
So I'll say I was impressed by how collaborative and thoughtful it was. It absolutely was the case that nothing that came out of the task force was any one person's product, nor would it necessarily have in its entirety fully pleased any one person. And then that continued to be true all the way through. But people were very, very thoughtful and engaged. And I don't know if it's been said already in this discussion, but every meeting was preceded by a memo that I wrote as the reporter. But it was addressing issues that had come up at the previous meeting, and that, you know, were there new things to be considered. The memo supported the different points of view and sort of teed up the discussion. And those memos sort of continued the standards as it went through each level of the ABA. And I was always impressed by how prepared people were and often how open they were to being influenced by the comments of other people who were involved. So it was sometimes a challenge as the reporter to be the one responsible for integrating all of the comments and coming up with sort of revised text to propose to the group then that was responsive, and then getting down particular comments and suggestions by others and just keeping the process moving. But it was really striking how, as I said, how prepared and engaged people were, and willing to at least listen to one another and sometimes have their minds changed.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought a lot about this as a reporter and what's my role and how the process should go forward. And also as someone in my scholarship who looks at the origin stories of some other really big rulemaking committees, for example, the rules of criminal procedure, federal criminal procedure and civil procedure. What I noticed about those, looking back in time, where those were a bit about a cult of personality. You have a really, really strong personality who is leading the charge and basically shaping the project. And thankfully, that is not the experience that I've had in the ABA. And I would say also, and this reflects what Jessica was saying about, say, the task force process, is each person on the task force not only brings a different point of view, but I think, and this gets to what Bruce is saying, is that there's a certain expectation that in many respects, at first we listen, we just try to find all the different sources that would inform these sets of standards. And because there's a diverse set of stakeholders on the task force, and we have a great chair, Raul Ayala, who basically gives everyone homework every time. And that every time means, where do we have gaps? And who can talk to who? And so everyone leaves in between these meetings with a punch list that involves listening, like listening tour after listening tour. And that becomes part of the way we approach the standards. And as Jessica said, it is collaborative. It's collaborative not just among the task force and then the standards committee, but it's also collaborative with the people that we reach out to. And then we report back to the task force what they had to say. So we really don't want to miss perspectives. So when we say compromise, I like the word collaborate better, because it just shows that we're really reaching out to the broader community to make sure that we reflect not just the landscape, but we also provide an aspirational view and, as Bruce said, kind of a best practices, a snapshot of the best practices right now.
Well, that's all very valuable in helping us understand the process more deeply. So thank you to all of you for sharing your experiences and insights there. So in talking about the history, let's now look forward. We're at 100 years as a section, and the Standards Project has been a big part of that. So what is the Standards Group working on right now? We've got a little bit of a sample of that in speaking with Ion. But what about the rest? As I understand it, you've just established goals for this upcoming ABA year. Can you also share those goals as in addition to just a general forward-looking impression of what's next?
Me too. So we are going to be very busy this coming year, and I'm very grateful to the members of the Standards Committee for all the time they're contributing to this. So at the moment, there are essentially 8 different projects underway. 4 are projects involving standards that have already been adopted, where the reporters are working on the commentary and our committee will be reviewing the commentary. So that includes the standards on discovery, which were just approved, and the standards I referred to on prosecution and defense function, which are very important and go back to the earliest days, standards on mental health, and also standards on dual jurisdiction youth that is a new set of standards, which is really interesting, and deal with young people who are not only involved in the juvenile justice system, but also involved in other systems at the same time, for example, foster care. And Bob Schwartz, who chaired that committee, is now finishing up the commentary, and we're in the process of reviewing it. And then there are 4 sets of standards that are now being drafted. One, you heard about the diversion standards from Ion. 2 others are revision projects. One, which is just a massive project, involves updating the 1986 juvenile justice standards. And that project has been going on quite some time. And then a more recently constituted working group is updating the sentencing standards. And then there's a new one that's just been formed, chaired by Virginia Kendall, judge in Illinois, who hasn't even met yet. It's really in formation, on victims and witnesses. And that'll be the first time the standards have looked specifically at that. Although, of course, many sets of standards look at that in varying degrees. So my committee is going to be overseeing those 8 projects in the coming year. And what we want to do is create a new group, a new task force, that will look at the other sets of standards that are older and have already been approved in order to look at how they ought to be updated, and particularly, but not exclusively, with an eye toward racial justice issues, which are so important nowadays. And that was a decision that was made by both our outgoing and our incoming chair, and I think that was a great idea on their part. So that's the answer to the short-term question. I think the answer to the long-term question is much more difficult. I don't imagine that if you'd asked the Standards Committee when it just finished up its work in 1974, what do you envision for the future, that they could have envisioned so many new sets of standards addressing new things that would occur in the criminal justice field, the DNA, for example, they couldn't have imagined. And so a lot of the current standards that we now have didn't have counterparts in the 1960s and 1970s. And likewise, I'm not sure I could really tell you where we're going to go forward from here. I think what we'll try to be doing is reflecting best practices on new issues as they arise, but bearing in mind that the process itself can take, you know, 4 or 5 or maybe even longer number of years. We're not dealing the way ABA policy can with fast-breaking issues, but issues that we think the criminal justice players, the judges, the prosecutors, defense lawyers, and others will be dealing with for years to come. So that was my evasive answer to your question about where we're going in the next 50 or 100 years. But I'm sure it will be continuing relevant project that reflect the best thinking of lots of people within the ABA and beyond.
Well, thank you. I think it is a difficult question to answer. So fair in sharing just what you can about it. You know, as you indicated, one of the positive things about the standards is that they address the most updated needs. Like you mentioned, DNA is an example of that. That's a great example. So that's fair. And thank you so much for sharing all of that history for us, particularly nice to do this year as we celebrate our centennial anniversary, which is actually this month on August 24th. So thank you for joining us in our reflection on our section's history. And thank you to all of you for joining us. And for our listeners, just before I wrap up, we have had several of the standards committees on our podcast already. We've heard about the mental health standards. We've also had an episode address the discovery standards that Bruce just mentioned, in addition to juvenile justice with Judge Ernst Gray. So there's plenty to look back on and listen to in greater detail if you're interested in learning more. And we will also post a link to the history that Bruce referenced in the details of this episode. So I encourage you to look into those. So thank you again to Bruce, Ian, and Jessica. And thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of the Just Pod.